Hi everyone, thanks for joining me again this week. It has been a busy week, which is what seems to happen when I'm at home because there's kind of an endless trail of things to do. And this is sort of the joy of working for yourself, the joy and the curse, in that it's great to have flexibility to do stuff whenever you want to do, but that kind of means you're doing stuff all of the time. But hey, that's cool because I like what I'm doing and I have fun doing all of the things, including this video. So let me jump into it. And the first thing that I wanted to touch on is I have launched a subscribe feature on my blog. Now, in some ways, this is very overdue. And in some ways, you may look at it and say, this is kind of pointless. So I thought I'd describe what I did and then also talk about the implementation, because some people were asking me about the mechanics of it. So in terms of why I've got it there, I had a subscribe link down the bottom in the past, and what it would do is it would fire you off to an if this then that recipe, which would look for a new RSS item. So I still have RSS site on the blog as well. When it found a new RSS item, it could send you an email, and then it was like, here is the entire blog post in the email. Now, there are a few things with that. So number one, if this then that seems to have stopped people from being able to share recipes publicly. The ones that were there already worked, so that one was okay, but I couldn't create new ones and tailor them. The other thing was, it's kind of like the entire post in an email, and frankly, it doesn't tend to translate very well, particularly once you do stuff like embed tweets that have media, which is something I used to do quite a bit of. You'd be better off sort of linking off separately and reading the post online in the context with all of the other content. So it was never really kind of a great solution. The other thing is, of course, it meant that you'd get an email every single time I blog. And I know that a lot of people like to consume stuff in a more aggregated fashion. So, for example, once a week. So that's it from sort of your side. From my side, one of the things that I have to keep thinking about is, as an independent, how do I try and make the most of my time and make the most of the content I produce? And one of the things that's hard is not having sort of a direct line through to people that are interested in what it is that I do. So when you go and use the IFTTT. When you use that, I don't have any visibility as to who's using it. You know, it's just like, hey, some people are consuming my RSS feed. So actually being able to know who is interested in the things I'm doing, and then later on having the ability to sort of say, well, hey, these are people that are interested, plus they've donated to me on Have I Been Pwned, which might be of some use in some way in the future. And in fact, let's be clear about it, because I don't like saying let's collect data because maybe I'll do something with it later on. It's very useful because I know who's supporting me and who's interested in what I'm doing. That's going to give me other options in terms of the way I communicate later on. Now, of course, amongst all of that, I more than just about anyone understand how important the privacy side of things is. So the last thing I'm going to be doing is spamming people. But starting to have a bit of information and knowing a bit more about the demographics of who's interested in what I'm doing is kind of important. So that's kind of the rationale. It gives a better experience to you guys, and it gives me some more choices to now do something with people that I know are interested in what it is that I do. Let's talk about the mechanics, because people were asking about this, and I did actually sort of share this earlier yesterday and went, hey, at a really quiet time of day, can some people go along and give this a run, see how it goes? I got some feedback, which I want to talk about now, and one thing I've got to fix as well. So first of all, the way I've built this is I'm using MailChimp, and it was always going to be some sort of online service, because delivering email, as I've learned from Have I Been Pwned, is not easy and it's not cheap, at least if you want to do it reliably and you want to do it in any sort of volume. So it was always going to be a service that is out there, and it was probably going to be something like Drip, and Drip is really popular. I gave that a run a little bit earlier on, or MailChimp or a few others. But MailChimp was just sort of the best as a lightweight way to get started. Things like Drip seem to be very orientated towards when you've got entire campaigns and you're monetizing your audience and you're doing stuff which, frankly, I don't want to do. Not at this stage. So MailChimp was just an easy solution, but I didn't want it to sort of be the experience of click a link on the blog and now you go over here and now you're on the MailChimp site and you do all the MailChimp things and you're sort of taken out of context. So what I did is use their API. So they've got an API. There is a NuGet package someone has built that's got a nice .NET wrapper around the API as well. And what I then did is I have a little blog helpers site. So you'll see if you do subscribe, you'll see a request go to, I think it's bloghelpers.troyhunt.com. And what I do there is I take the request that says someone wants to sign up and I plug into MailChimp's API, submit the data through there. The way I've done the client implementation on my blog is that if you scroll down, if you're on my blog already, or if you go to troyhunt.com and have a look at the bottom, you'll see that there's just a couple of fields. So there is a field which says, how frequently would you like to get emails? So either once a day or once a week. Now, either way, they send at 8 p.m. my time in Australia, and we're about GMT plus 10 or 11, depending on the time of year. Actually, we're always the same here because we don't have daylight saving. 10 or 11 hours ahead of GMT. And I picked 8 o'clock because normally I tend to blog around the 6:30, 7 p.m. my time, which works really good for European audiences where a lot of my followers are. And what's going to happen then is either if I've blogged one or more times during the day, you get an email at 8 p.m. And then what happens is, I mean, if I haven't blogged, you get nothing. On the weekly one, it does it at 8 p.m. on a Friday night. So I'm recording this at the time recording is about a 10:45 Friday morning. I'll edit this, produce it. The Australian internet will take ages to do its thing. It'll go online. I'll publish it later on. And then this will sort of be the last in the chain of things for the week. And they'll go out in the weekly cadence. So anyway, there's the bit about how frequently do you want it. Then there's the email address. And then what you'll find when you fill it out is you'll get a captcha. Now, I know that people don't like captchas. I don't like captchas. It is Recapture 2, so it's the one with the little checkbox, and that does make life a lot easier. What I'm finding is that because I wanted to implement this in a way where the capture would only load, like anything at all, only comes from Google, after you go through and you actually fill in your email address and the cadence and click the submit button, and then it dynamically embeds everything. Now, it seems because of that, that people continually get challenged to pick like the server stations or click on the boxes with the trees. You've probably seen this before if you've used Recapture 2. And normally that happens when confidence level drops beneath a certain threshold. So when have I been pwned, for example, I rarely see that pop up because I'm loading everything when the page loads. On my blog, it seems to pop up every time. So I suspect it's just the way I'm dynamically loading the Recapture into the page where it hasn't established enough confidence about the legitimacy of the user. I prefer that model as opposed to loading it for everyone because I've tried to make my blog as lightweight as possible and I don't want every single time the page loads for you guys to have to load Recapture stuff that you're not gonna need 99 point something percent of the time. So that's why the Recapture is being extra suspicious. I'm pretty sure that's why it's being extra suspicious. In terms of why I need it, once you submit that form, you will get an email because this is the double opt-in process that good mail providers enforce in order to try and stop spam. So because you're going to get an email as soon as you submit that form, I have to have a captcha because otherwise you know that someone is going to just take a great big list of email addresses, plug them all into my API, and all those people are going to get emails. They're going to get, quite rightly, pissed off. And my spam rating is going to suffer and MailChimp will get upset and bad things happen. So I have to have a capture there. Have to have anti-automation. I will look at invisible recapture, but I think I might have the same problem in terms of how it loads. Now, I know this is taking a while, but trust me, it's people asked. I want to clarify it. Once you get the mail saying, hey, are you really, really sure you want to get opted in? And you click it and you go to MailChimp, they give you another recapture. I don't know why they do that. So this has sort of been the predominant feedback from people. Look, it's easy, but do you really need two recaptures? I'm not sure why they do that, given that there's a recapture in front of actually sending the mail in the first place. My only theory on this is that mail providers are just being so cautious about avoiding any sort of spam or automation or anything else nasty that it is probably through an abundance of caution that they've done this. It is what it is. Apparently, you cannot turn it off. I have looked into it. So my apologies for having to do two checkbox clicks and possibly choose service stations or dogs or whatever it is they put in the Google pictures these days. Anyway, so that's how it works. I'm pretty happy with the way that's all put together. That is, by the way, in case you don't know, everything on troyhunt.com, the whole ghost theme, there is actually a GitHub repository on that. You can go and check it all out. I'll make sure I push all of that into the repository before I publish this video. So if you want to actually have a look at the non-obfuscated, minimized JavaScript and everything in there, you can go and check that out. The one bug I have that I will try and fix before the end of today, before I publish this, is one that very, very, very few people would see because it's a bug in the way IE11 handles it. So it doesn't seem to be very happy with the XML HTTP request, which is made asynchronously from the page. I'm sure that's going to be a minor thing, and I'll have a look at it and get it fixed, because even though there's not a lot of people using IE11 on my blog, I would like to make it work. Right, so that is that. I know that's gone on for a while, but hopefully that clarifies why I've done this, how I've done it, and then why the behavior with the recaptures is as it is. Next thing, very briefly on this. Last week, I talked about this Apple scam, right? Or Apple scam, Apple threat extortion, where the Turkish crime family were going to delete hundreds of millions of accounts unless they got tens of thousands of dollars from Apple, which they were never going to get. And at the time, I said, look, it's a beat up. Here's where all the accounts came from. They largely came from the Evony data breach. Some of them might work. Surprise, surprise. Friday came and went. So this was only about a week ago, Friday my time. So the deadline that they had came and went, no accounts deleted. Certainly nothing that made any news. You know, I don't know, maybe they got one or two. Nothing made any news. And I'm looking at this going, well, you're kind of screwed now, right? Like, you're going to look like a bunch of idiots, which they kind of already were anyway. So how are you going to deal with this? Like, what are you going to say? And I'm watching the Twitter and they're like, we're negotiating with Apple. It's like, okay, you're not negotiating with Apple, but let's see where this goes. And then they come out and they show a transaction, a Bitcoin transaction in the blockchain that's like $400,000 or something. And it's funny to watch a number of people like, wow, that's amazing, dude. You know, like, that's crazy. Now, of course, immediately this is not going to have been Apple paying them anything. Not only that, but it's very, very, very highly unlikely anyone gave them $400,000 for anything. That would probably well and truly exceed the pocket money I suspect that most of them get on a weekly or monthly basis, or whatever kids get these days. So I'm looking at this going, what's happened, right? So I am by no means a blockchain expert. I don't quite understand the mechanics of the cryptocurrency. I did find someone who does, and here's the way they explained it. I'm going to read off my notes here. They said the transaction was an internal treasury move of Bitcoin at a Korean Bitcoin exchange, which is much less sensational than a bunch of hackers or wannabe hackers just got paid 400 grand from Apple or someone else wanting to protect accounts. They've gone very quiet since then. So basically, the Twitter account has just died. They've all scattered off to wherever they go, which according to one report, one of them was actually arrested, which is probably a good thing given what they were doing. I think we've seen the end of all that, but it's just going to sort of serve as a cautionary tale of when we see these sensational claims about hackers and access to accounts and things. The generally sort of the default position is it is bullshit until we prove otherwise. And that was certainly the case here. That's those guys. I did a webinar very early yesterday morning. I got up very early yesterday morning because that's what happens when you live in Australia. Like, all the business hours are at funny times for us somewhere else. So I got up early yesterday morning and I did a webinar for Cloudflare on handling malicious traffic. Now, this is related to one of their features that I was dogfooding for them for a bit. And I was dogfooding this through Have I Been Pwned? And they have a rate limiting feature. Now, as you may or may not know, I have a rate limiting feature within Have I Been Pwned as well. And I introduced this last year because I was seeing traffic which I wasn't happy was legitimate, or wasn't happy that was non-malicious, you know, not ethical enough. So I put in a rate limit and I said, you get one request every 1500 milliseconds and that's it. Any more than that and you get HTTP 429 returned, which is too many requests. And then you get a retry after header, which says, you know, give it, for argument's sake, 2 seconds before you try again. And I put this in place and I thought, this will fix it, right? Like, people will make too many requests and then the rate limit will come back and I go, oh, maybe we should slow down. But it didn't. And in fact, it went the other way, because I think people got kind of pissed off and they're like, let's just hammer the bejesus out of you and see how much traffic we can throw your way. So there were three things that I ultimately talked about in this Cloudflare webinar, And by the way, it was recorded. It will be available. I will share links with you and talk about it in a weekly update once it is. But it was only just over 24 hours ago, so I don't think they've got it prepared yet. So three things I talked about. Number one, caching. So having a cache at an edge in front of your underlying origin infrastructure is awesome. It is really, really essential for a few different reasons. So number one is that it makes it fast for people. So if you use Cloudflare, and they've got like 107 edge nodes around the world now as well, and just for full disclosure, they don't pay me for this. So they didn't pay me for the webinar. They've given me access to some of their features just for Have I Been Pwned, which I've been dogfooding, and that's it. I just think it's a good thing. So anyway, they've got the 107 odd edge nodes around the world, which means that if you're in anywhere close to one of those 107 edge nodes and you can get something from cache, you get it really, really fast. Doesn't have to go back to the origin. So number one is that it's good, fast connections for your user. Now also number, let's call it 1.1, is that they support HTTP2. A lot of web servers don't. We only got HTTP2 support in IIS 10, which launched with Server 2016 late last year. There's still no HTTP2 in Azure platform as a service, for example. Cloudflare does have HTTP2. So if you've got, say, a whole bunch of images, like what I've got on the Pwned websites page of Have I Been Pwned, then those can be served from cache, from a point close to the user, over HTTP2, which means I can come down in a binary stream, which makes it a super, super fast set of requests because they all come down sort of asynchronously, and you get like speed on top of speed. So very, very good for the end user. Now, the other thing is that because it's coming from their edge node in cache, and this is on all the free plans as well with Cloudflare, you're not serving it from your origin. You're not paying egress traffic fees. I have to pay for egress traffic on Azure. And it's not a lot of money unless your volumes are actually crazy, but this does reduce my outbound cost by some tens of dollars a month, which is cool. Like, that's a few coffees. That's good. So it's good in that regard. The other thing is that I was actually seeing malicious traffic targeted at Have I Been Pwned as get requests to the homepage, which is kind of the most pointless malicious traffic ever, because that's a really, really lightweight page. And when I started seeing this, I was like, I know what I'll do. I'll block these IP addresses and that'll stuff them. However, I thought, well, hang on a second. It's static content. I'll just serve it from cache. I don't care if you make like a billion requests a second, if you can make a billion requests a second. You get it from Cloudflare's edge node. Won't touch my origin. And I show a graph in the webinar of a sort of they've got a graph where it shows here's how much traffic hits your origin and here's how much goes from cache. And there's like this great big curve up the top, which is all your cache. And then there's just this flat line down the bottom of just about nothing comparatively, which hits the origin. And I showed her I was serving more than 99% of my traffic at one stage just from cache. Didn't have to hit the origin. So caching, awesome. The other thing I'll talk about is using the firewall. So they have a firewall where you can block IP addresses. You can JavaScript challenge IP addresses, which basically makes sure a bot can't come from that IP. It has to be a browser which loads a page that has a few little balls that go across it, checks you're a legit browser, and then you're good. You can call their API to put IP addresses on the list that gets the block or the JavaScript challenge. So what I'm doing with Have I Been Pwned is I'm identifying malicious traffic, and I'm not going to tell you exactly what my rules are there, but I've got a series of rules which go, this IP address is looking malicious, call the API on Cloudflare to submit that IP address and give them a JavaScript challenge. I've written about that before, about how I used Azure Functions to do that, and that's awesome. So that's number two, that's firewall. Number three is their rate limiting feature. Now, I mentioned earlier on, I implemented my own rate limit in app. The problem is that I still need to be able to process requests and return 429 from my origin to clients that are excessively hitting the service. So I've got to be able to process that. Someone asked the question after the webinar, they said, can't I just have like an Nginx module to do this? Well, you can, but you've still got to be able to process it on your origin. And when you get bombarded with enough traffic, you're literally going to be DDoSed and you're not going to be able to process all of that traffic and legitimately return the 429. The joy of having a server sitting in front of your origin, making the decision for you, is that that service can decide whether the traffic goes through to your origin or not. So that service can do the rate limiting. And what it means now is that when I get huge volumes of requests from the one IP address that exceed the rate limit, it's Cloudflare that's rejecting that. It's not me having to process it. So I walk you through how to set this up, and it's really simple. You can go through and, for example, you could say one IP address should not be able to make more than 2,000 requests to my site per minute. And if it does, I'm going to block it for X number of minutes, hours, days. Which is cool, right? So now you've actually got control over what are the conditions that trigger a rate limit, and then what do I want to do for how long once it's triggered. And you can do that either across the whole site or for discrete resources as well. So I've got like a catch-all for the whole site, and then I've got one that's a lot stricter around the API endpoints that people are abusing. None of this is foolproof either. If someone gets enough bots and enough discrete IP addresses and they can make enough requests, you're still going to have various problems of different kinds. But what you're doing here is you're continually raising the bar, making it harder and harder and harder to take you offline. Harder to take you offline, harder for them to economically sustain that activity, and less likely to cause you problems. So that's really good. I will share that webinar once it's out. Right, next thing. Told you there was a lot of stuff this week. Yesterday, I wrote my Security Sense column, and I called it Security is Becoming Too Hard for the Layperson. And there was something that sort of triggered this yesterday. There was an interview I did. I had one of the radio stations here call me up. I wanted to talk about National Get a VPN Day. Now, I never knew that there was a National Get a VPN Day, which seemed kind of weird to me. But anyway, I'm going to come back to the VPN because when I started thinking about it, I thought about all the security constructs we try and give people in order to protect themselves. All right, so normal, everyday people. And when you start combining them together, it gets really hard for people to do the right thing. So for example, password managers. Try getting a non-techie to use a password manager, like consistently across everything. It's a pain because you're sort of going, well, all right, this website over here, this one actually won't let you use one because it blocks it. This one over here, that's your bank. That has a soft keyboard with buttons that move around and you have to actually click each one. You can't do that. That one over there, you can't generate a password for because they don't allow dashes or dollar signs or sometimes don't allow anything that's not a number. And there's all these other conditions that actually make it hard for all of us, but really, really hard for non-technical people to use it. So there's that. 2FA is another good one. If you're watching me and listening to my things, you're probably security minded. You probably have 2FA or multi-step verification on multiple things. It's a bunch of stuff to set up. You've got to go through and manually configure it. If, depending on the service, it may want to send you an SMS. You may not always have coverage. Someone left a comment on one of my posts only a couple of days ago saying 2FA is useless to me because I don't have coverage for my cell phone at my house. Now, of course, you have soft 2FA implementations or multi-step verification implementations like Authy. Now you've got to explain to people, you've got to go and get that app and you've got to set it up and you do the QR thing where you hold it up at the screen. It's more barriers to entry. Device pins. How many people do you see that don't have a pin on their device? And something like the iPhone that I'm using at the moment is awesome because there's Touch ID. But I helped someone recently, a non-technical person, set up Touch ID on their iPhone. And watching them try to get the thumb on the right spot and you got to roll it all the way around. And then you really got to do a couple of thumbs as well. It's not a simple thing. And then the thing which prompted the whole call with the radio station was about VPN. So the reason we had National Get a VPN Day yesterday is because it was the start of the period or the first day of the period where all of our ISPs in Australia must retain metadata about all of our browsing habits just in case one of us turns out to be a terrorist one day. Now this in sentiment is similar to the Snoopers Charter in the UK, or as you meant to call it, the Investigatory Powers Act. It is not dissimilar to issues in the US around things like the act about ISPs not selling your data just having been repealed. All the same sort of box of problems of ISPs storing your data. And the journalist is talking to me and he's like, all right, well, should everyone have a VPN all of the time? Because this is what the EFF says. EFF says everyone should get a VPN and turn on all the time. And I'm going, well, no, because that is actually problematic in multiple ways. Number one, you got to go out and buy one. I love Freedome. I use Freedome extensively. I recommend anyone who travels and they need to connect in dodgy airports or even if you're going to cafes, get it and use it. But I don't use it every single day because not only do I not want to wear the latency cost of turning it on, but as I tweeted yesterday, I can't watch Netflix when it's on because Netflix won't work with the VPN provider. Many people then replied to that and said, yeah, and then there's all these e-commerce sites and other things that strictly, deliberately block VPNs because people use VPN to obfuscate identities. The point is that as good as VPNs are, they also cause a bunch of problems. And you can't tell your average everyday layperson to use a VPN all the time because you're going to make their life worse. The gap here, or the one bit where it kind of makes a bit more sense, is for your everyday average layperson, help them with a VPN and say when you are doing something which requires privacy, where you really want to have confidence that people aren't looking at your metadata or things like that, then you turn it on. Now, we could all speculate about nasty, nefarious things that may be within that category, but they're very legitimate things as well. So as I said in the interview yesterday, if you have a disease and you really don't want to share that disease with anyone else, you really want to turn your VPN on before you're reading about that disease. And even if it's an HTTPS website, you've still got DNS queries and TLS negotiation phase sending the host name of that website out over the connection. I think I spoke about that last week. So VPN makes sense there. And what you're doing now is you're trusting the VPN provider, who I trust a lot more than the ISP. And by the way, just incidentally, for any Australian government or other governments listening, the terrorists have figured this out too, right? So this, you know, I'm sorry, because I know that this totally throws your metadata retention plans into disarray. They've worked it out. It is a pointless law. Moving on past that, the big thing for me this week, my Pluralsight course, which I think I've mentioned in the past, has gone live, the HTTPS Pluralsight course. What every developer must know about HTTPS finally hit just under 24 hours ago. It took a bit longer than I would have liked to get through the final sort of approval processes and everything at Pluralsight, but it is now out there. And I wrote a blog post about it because I write blog posts to launch these things. And I gave a couple of examples here, which I have tweeted in the past, but it's worth calling out again in case you missed them because they're kind of funny when it comes to the understanding people have about HTTPS. And one of them is really cool, well, cool, sad, depending on your perspective, noteworthy, because it is, this one popped up a few weeks ago. It's an oilandgasinternational.com website. And what's happened here is that they've been serving their login page over HTTP, and Firefox, I think it was as of Firefox 51 and as of Chrome 56, they start telling people, you probably can't trust this website, because guess what? You probably can't trust this website. And the really funny thing here, though, is that someone from this company lodged a bug report with Mozilla, and they've said here, your notice of insecure password and or login automatically appearing on the login for my website, Oil and Gas International, is not wanted and was put there without our permission. Now, this, just in case you're going, hang on, well, what's going on here? This is not changing the website in situ on the server or anything. This is just literally the browser showing the warning, and I've got a screen cap of it here, on the oil and gas website, which says, this connection is not secure. Logins entered here could be compromised. Learn more. And this is the browser implementing this as someone's on the website. Anyway, the bug report goes on. Please remove it immediately. We have our own security system and it has never been breached in more than 15 years. Your notice is causing concern by our subscribers and is detrimental to our business. Yes, because that's the whole point. We want it to cause concern because you can't trust the page. The page could have been maliciously modified. Someone could be stealing credentials. Man in the middle. So that was kind of funny, and I've put that there because it really speaks to the issue here of the people building these services just fundamentally not understanding the value of HTTPS and the risk of unencrypted traffic. That is really important. That is something that everyone building websites needs to understand. And I suspect, again, my audience being probably a lot more security aware than your average set of developers is probably aware of that. It's all the tips and tricks and nuances in order to make that successful that are important. So within the course, I talk about stuff like, here's how to use the upgrade insecure request content security policy such that if you screw up and you accidentally embed something insecurely, it fixes it and the browser sort of saves you from yourself. I'll give one more example here. Wickham District Council. Now, these guys put out a tweet 4 days ago, and the tweet says, technical hitch with our website. Click continue to this website or advanced to access content. Working to fix ASAP. What they're saying here is that when you go to the Wickham District Council, your browser is going to tell you there's a problem. Big warning, big security warning. Here is how to circumvent the warning. It's just, again, unfathomably stupid. Now, look, I get the perspective that if it was all just HTTP, there wouldn't be a problem anyway, and there's probably not going to be a problem, and it's probably just kind of static content. But their advice is basically saying you'll get a warning about security, or you're getting a warning about security. Best thing you can do is ignore it, move on, get your job done. Now, I go on to show the root cause of the problem. And the root cause of the problem is that they tweeted about this 2 days after their certificate expired. They've got a GoDaddy certificate here, which may indicate other things they probably should be thinking about. But be that as it may, they let the certificate expire. And that is a problematic thing. And this sort of goes to or speaks to the whole issue here, and I talk about this quite a bit in the course, about the overhead of managing an HTTPS environment. And one of the things that people have often stated as being a barrier to HTTPS adoption is that there's an overhead, right? Not just when you set it up, but every year you've got to come back, you've got to renew it, otherwise you end up like these guys and people can't access your site. So I talk about using Let's Encrypt, for example, and having automated renewals of certificates. I talk about Cloudflare, similar sort of deal. They just keep the certificate rolling over. So that was that. I will link to that blog post because there's some funny examples. Some other stuff here around the likes of HSBC in the UK. So HSBC were loading their homepage insecurely. Now you would then click a link to go to the login page. Login page would load securely and then everything was good. But I kind of looked at this and went, well, do we really want banks loading the page insecurely, like the landing page? During the course of me writing the course, they actually went secure. But unfortunately, they put mixed content on the page and we had the problems that, you know, padlock goes away, green bits go away. So there's that one there. Quick overview of what's actually in the course. There's 5 modules. Number 1, HTTPS value proposition. So I talk about how quickly we're moving forward. About 20% of the Alexa top 1 million is now HTTPS. Growth rates are astronomical. I think we're sort of getting into the realm of up to sort of doubling every 12 to 18 months in terms of that percentage of the Alexa top million that are adopting it. I talk about the fact that Mozilla was reporting more than 50% of requests to the internet were now secure. Obviously, a lot of requests go to Facebook, Twitter, this sort of stuff that does their crypto very well. Module 2, HTTPS fundamentals. So I talk about things like TLS negotiation. So if you're a dev and you've never sort of thought, how does the client and the server actually figure out how to talk securely? That's really worthwhile because it's important to understand that there is a negotiation phase where the browser says, hey, I support these protocols and cipher suites. And the server says, I support those ones and here's my public key. And they do this in an observable way that a man in the middle can see, which goes back to my earlier point about VPNs. So fundamentals is really important and it will teach most devs things that they don't know, they haven't seen before. Number 3, securing the application. And this is kind of the heart of it. So this is everything from we should be 301ing responses, but we've still got this problem of intercepting the first request. So we should have HSTS, but then we've got a trust on first use problem. So you should preload it. And then there's the upgrade insecure requests I spoke about before. There's also a CSP to block insecure requests. and a whole bunch of other things, even stuff like the importance of secure flags on cookies. So all of that's really important. That's the nuts and bolts of it. Number four, overcoming perceived barriers to adoption. And this sort of tackles some of the issues I spoke about before. So people thinking that there's an ongoing maintenance overhead. Also tackles the cost issue as well. Because a lot of people go, oh, if I want to get HTTPS, I've got to spend money. I've got to buy a certificate. And of course, Let's Encrypt and Cloudflare in particular help us overcome that. And finally, beyond the basics. And here I talk about a bunch of other things that are not essential for developers to know to do their job, but are actually really valuable to know, really useful info. So things like how to use SSL Labs to check your configuration, a bunch of acronyms, DANE, CFAA, DNSSEC, all of these things, very briefly what they mean and why they're important. So all of that's really cool. And then just by pure coincidence, only within the last couple of hours, I had to put some of this into place myself because someone sent me a tweet and they said, hey, you're a safer web project. So this is the one that is the automated security configuration scanner for ASP.NET websites, which has gone a bit unloved. It's in maintenance mode now because I put most of my focus on have I been pwned. He said, hey, Chrome 58, which is still in beta, is blocking your site. And normally when people do this, I'm like, okay, well, this is going to be they've got an old client or something like this, or they've got some funky man-in-the-middle stuff screwing with their connection. What I realized is that Chrome 58 was flagging the fact that a safer web uses a StartCom certificate. Now, StartCom got themselves into a bunch of hot water because they got acquired by WoSign, who also got themselves into a bunch of hot water around October last year for doing lots of dodgy stuff around the way they issue certs. All of them found themselves in a bunch of trouble with Mozilla, who said, you're not behaving like good CAs should behave. So what we're going to do is we're going to work towards detrusting certificates. And Chrome actually said, look, if you issue a certificate for StartCom or WoSign after, I think it was about the 21st of October, then as of Chrome 56, which hit in January, you're going to get detrusted, which means you get warnings when you go to the site. And the site won't load and you'll be back into the Wickham District Council sort of set of advice. And then they said, over a longer period of time, we're going to detrust any of the older certificates as well in our next browsers. So when I went over to SSL Labs and I plugged a safer web in, it came back and said, look, you got an A-plus rating on your SSL, but as of, I think, about May 18, sometime next month, you're going to get a T-grade. And T is for trust. You're going to be detrusted. So the first really interesting thing here is keep an eye on this stuff, because if you're not actually watching what's happening in the industry, what's happening to things like CAs that you may have used, you may find yourself in the same boat as Wickham and in the same boat as I would have been if I hadn't have got this tweet and actually thought about it a little bit more practically. I've actually written a blog post on this, which I'll publish early next week after DNS has done its thing, because what I did is I went, all right, easy win. I'm just going to put it behind Cloudflare. And when I put it behind Cloudflare, people are going to get a Cloudflare cert. Cloudflare can then talk to a safer web using the StartCom cert. And what I'll do as soon as I'm happy DNS has done everything is I'll get one of Cloudflare's Origin CA certs, which is free, and I'll do that. And the interesting thing is, and I say this in the blog post I've drafted, from the tweet about finding out there was a problem to having completely fixed it and written an entire blog post about it was about 30 minutes and didn't cost me a cent. And this is the sort of stuff that we need to understand about HTTPS today, because this stuff can be really easy to get on top of and really easy to do well. You just got to know the tricks. I'm really excited about that course. I hope it does fantastically. I think it's a really good time for it. I'll see how it goes, but please check that out and share that generously. Everything I earn from Pluralsight is royalty-based, so I depend on people actually watching the course in order to make any money from it, and there's a heap of work in this one. All right, last thing, sponsorship. So Titania is still sponsoring me. They were on board last week. They do a bunch of security things, including the fact that they have a very, very nice Star Wars theme for explaining what they do, which is kind of cool. But more specifically, they have things like a free risk assessment tool, So you can go and download this tool. You can run it on your local machine. It will look at your network around you, obviously footprint everything that's out there, come back and give you a picture of what you have in your environment and where you might have some problems. That's there for free. There's a link up in my sponsor bar. I'll also put a mention of them in the references as well. So please show your support to them. They're a British-based security company, and it's nice to have them on board. They were there last week as well. So that's Titania. I did have vacant sponsorship spots from this Sunday onwards. I decided to actually be a bit proactive and contact existing sponsors or previous sponsors and offer them some spots. As such, I've booked out a significant portion of the rest of the year. So I think I've booked out solid until sometime in July. And then there are a couple of them who came along and said, yeah, give us 1 week every month for the rest of the year, which is fantastic because that is keeping me well and truly looked after in terms of always having someone up there and obviously being paid for that. And it sort of, when I thought about it, I went, well, I was just letting it all kind of happen organically. I was never sort of reaching out to people. And it almost sort of comes full circle now back to the thing I spoke about with the subscription service, where it's very hard for me as an independent, where I want to keep writing stuff and producing stuff and putting stuff out there and doing what I do. I often never think about I've got to actually try and make a living out of all of this as well. So I am going to try and start to think more about what are the right ways to use these relationships and use the interest that people have in what I do in productive and responsible and ethical ways. And if people have got ideas about that or comments, if you think that there's too much sponsorship or not enough or whatever it is, please let me know. I am honestly just figuring this out as I go. You know, like I talk to people and I get ideas, but for the most part, I'm going, let's give this a go. See if that works all right. So do please share your feedback. I take it all on board and I take it all seriously. Thanks very much for watching. I know this has been a long one because there has been a lot happening. Who knows what will happen between now and next week, but I will talk to you again then. Thanks, guys.